18 verses of chapter 10. And the reason we didn't look at all of chapter 10 is because it's like 43 or something verses, so that we would have been here a long time. But it's important to look back just real quick at what we looked at last week. If you remember, the southern Canaanite kings that banded together against Israel and how God led them in victory of that. And so we looked at, again, the first 15 verses to kind of get an idea of what was going on. And in the rest of chapter 10, we see that each of the southern kingdoms was named specifically. And then it was talked about in that chapter how it was described. And so each of the five cities were mentioned by name. And then there was a little in-depth of how Israel defeated that city. And so, again, it's important to know and to look at that. And if you want to read back later, I encourage you to do so, to do that. Because how God led Israel to defeat all of them is important. And the big picture, as we work through this book together, I wanted to zoom out a little bit so that we're not spending so much time there. Because we got to the point and the gist of it is that they won. Israel defeated them. God provided the victory. And there was a lot to get to in chapter 11. But that's the rest of chapter 10. And so we're going to zoom out. We're going to pick back up in chapter 11. And believe it or not, it should sound a little bit similar, because as we've gone through this journey with Israel, it almost seems like it's a cycle and we're at another familiar point in the cycle. But we're going to pick up in verse 4. Here in chapter 11, and look and see, now that Israel's defeated the southern kingdoms, now they've continued their conquest, what lies ahead. So if you'll join me, Joshua chapter 11, we're just going to look at verses 4 and 5 real quick to set up what is going on. And so it says, "And they came out with all of their troops, a great horde in number of that like sand on the seashore. And they had very many horses and chariots, and all of these kings joined forces and came and encamped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel." Now, this might sound familiar, because in chapter 10, last week, we looked at the southern kingdoms that did something very similar, right? They came together. They were afraid of what Israel was doing, of how they were just blowing through some of the best that the Canaanite tribes had to offer. And here, we see the northern tribes doing the exact same thing. The northern tribes look, and if you look in verses 1 through 3, it kind of sets that up. Very similar language. They looked and they saw what Israel was doing. They saw what Israel did at Jericho. They saw what Israel did at Ai. And now they saw what Israel did to all the southern cities. And they were afraid. They knew that they were next. They knew that Israel was coming against them. And it should sound familiar, because again, we're in this cycle of what God is having Israel do, and they decided to band together. They saw Israel fighting for their God and demolishing everything in their path, whether it be the walls of Jericho, whether it be the city of Ai, whether it be all of the southern cities that were essentially powerhouses. But this one's a little bit different, and if you look at those verses we read, because it notes the size and the strength of the army that they were facing. So this was all the northern tribes banding together, but it talks about, in verse 4, the size of the army. And they compared the size of the army to the grains of sand on a beach. Now this was a size of an army that they'd never faced before. Jericho provided its own challenges in its impenetrable walls and the way that it was set up. The city of Ai provided its own challenges and how that happened. And the southern cities, it took a long time for that to take place. But this was a size and a scale of an army that they had never seen before. And not only that, they were a more advanced army than they've ever seen before. Joshua notes here that they were equipped with horses and chariots. This was a technologically advanced army for the time. And it was a far more dangerous army than Israel had ever faced before. I mean, considering all that we've walked and seen Israel go through and conquer and do, when standing face to face with an enemy of this size, this magnitude, and of this danger, we could understand maybe if there was a little bit of fear of what was going on. But the fact of the matter is, God was preparing them for this the entire way. You see, Jericho, all the way back in chapter 6, and their victory in Jericho prepared them for their victory in Ai in chapter 8, their correct victory. If you remember, they stumbled a little bit along the way, tried to do it themselves, suffered a defeat, and then they regrouped. They allowed God to take control, and they did that. And what they learned from Jericho helped them in the correct way to take the city of Ai. And when they took the city of Ai, they learned a little bit more about God and who he was and how he would provide. And they used that in order to take the southern cities that we talked about last week. But all of that was preparing them for this. This is the culmination of everything. If you ever grew up playing any of those video games that get progressively harder as you go along, this is one of those boss battles at the very end that you accumulate everything and you learn, because this is it. And now, maybe this week, maybe this morning, you can identify with what Israel's facing a little bit, because maybe we're facing a battle in life. Maybe you're facing a battle in life that seems daunting. Maybe you're facing a battle in life that seems bigger and absolutely daunting, and something that you're scared to take on. Maybe something bigger and crazier and scarier than you've ever seen before. But take heart, because the fact that you're still standing here to fight that battle shows that God has already been faithful to bring you to the point that you're at. And he will remain so with whatever it is that we will face. You see, God was with Israel when they were scared at Jericho. God was with Israel when they were scared at Ai, when they were scared of these southern cities. And he delivered every single time. He was with them every step of the way. And though they're facing a very dangerous army, they're facing opposition like they've never faced before, hopefully they've learned from their victories and maybe even in their defeats that God is going to be with them. And now, if you've noticed as we've walked through the book of Joshua so far together, that when Israel faces victories, you're going to hear God send some encouragement and instruction. Yet when they face defeats, they try to do it on their own. So let's take a look in verses 6 through 9 here and see what kind of battle it's going to be this time around. So Joshua chapter 11, starting in verse 6. And if I butcher some of the names, forgive me, please. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them, for tomorrow at this time I will give all of them over to you, slain to Israel. You shall hamstring their horses, and you shall burn their chariots with fire." So Joshua and all of his warriors came suddenly against them by the waters of Merom and fell upon them. And the Lord gave them into the hand of Israel, who struck them and chased them as far as Great Sidon and whatever that place is, and eastward as far as the valley of Mizpeh, and struck them until they left none remaining. And Joshua did to them just as the Lord had said to them. He hamstrung their horses, and he burned their chariots with fire. So if you've been paying attention as we walk through these, the fact that God says, "Do not be afraid, for I am with you," we get an idea of how the outcome is going to be, because we've seen it multiple times before. When God instructs Joshua, when God instructs Israel and says, "Do this and don't be afraid because I'm going to be with you," every single time that's been the case, Israel has had an easy victory. The times Israel has suffered defeat, we don't see God say that. We see people come together and devise a plan. We see people say, "You know, I know God said wait and do this, but we want to do that." But here we see that God encourages Joshua, God empowers Joshua, and we see once again the armies are defeated. And it's real easy to look at this and just be like, yeah, Israel won again, right? Here we are. This is now the fourth time in 11 chapters that we've seen them take a major victory. But again, remember the scale of this victory. This is the most impressive victory. If you thought Jericho was impressive, and we like to spend time talking about that, and you know, in children's ministry and VeggieTales and all that focuses on Jericho. But that's the way that the narrative of Joshua is if you thought Jericho was impressive, look what they did at Ai. If you thought Ai was impressive, look what they did to the southern cities. If you thought the southern cities were impressive, look what they did to the northern cities. And we may even take another step in this chapter. But God delivers. the same reassurance and comfort that he did in each of the victories. And it's important for us to note the difference, that when the victories were faced, it was because God was at the center. It wasn't Joshua's plan, it wasn't Israel's plan, it was God's plan done through Israel and Joshua. Again, they were facing the scariest sight that they had ever seen yet on this conquest. But in verse 6, God commanded them the exact same way that he had done in all the previous battles before. Do not be afraid, for I have already delivered them into your hands. And we've talked about this before. The victory was already there. God had already promised the victory. The battle had already been won. Israel just simply had to show up. And God was going to do what God was going to do. And we see in verses 7 through 9, as we read together, how it takes place, and we just get a brief synopsis of this battle, not focusing so much on the battle, but again, the outcome. But we see Israel attacks with boldness and even a little bit of strategy. The way that it's worded, it makes it seem that there was an unexpected ambush, that Joshua and Israel, when they attacked, it was in a way that they were not prepared for, and it was a good way to do it because that's how God wanted them to do it. But we also see Israel attacks with obedience. And so much so, and I want you, there's a point in there to consider. God told them to go in and to destroy the horses and the chariots, right? And remember, that's what made them technologically superior to Israel. On paper, if you're looking at a smaller army against a larger army that's got chariots and horses, it's not really an issue. You know who's going to win that fight because of the size and the technological advancements that are there. Israel could have very easily said, you know, we've got an opportunity here. Not only do we know that we're going to win, but there are some things that they have that we could use. We could use some horses. We could use some chariots in our conquest. But did they really? And God shows that they really didn't need those things because they won a swift victory without any of those things. And it wasn't because of military strategy. It wasn't because of chariots and horses. It was because they were following the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. They were following the God of Israel, and so they didn't need chariots and horses. And God wanted to make the point so much that he had them destroy those very things that other people would look at and say, they're better off because they have those things. But the fact of the matter is, Israel was better off because they were serving God. They destroyed those chariots and horses. They could have easily captured them, taken them for themselves, used them in future endeavors. But they did, and they obeyed exactly what God had asked them to do. And again, this is Israel learning from their mistakes, because if you remember, when we saw the Battle of Jericho, we see part of the issue, part of the defeat that they suffered was because when they took Jericho, they took some things from Jericho that God said not to worry about. They took some riches. They took some valuables that they could use because they wanted so, and God made that right. And so they could have easily done the exact same thing here, saw something and said, you know, this could work to our advantage, this could be better for us. But they learned their lesson. This time, unlike what happened at Jericho, which resulted in their first defeat at the city of Ai in chapter 7, they've learned from, and God said to completely destroy and not take anything, and they have seen God come through many, many times, and they did so yet again. And we see Israel attacks also with commitment, because it mentions in Scripture that they did not let up until the mission was complete. They continued their attack, they continued their advancement, because God said that all of them needed to be destroyed. And so they did not let up until the mission was accomplished. And so for you and for me, maybe it's important to look at when we face those difficult times, when we face these instances, and we may not be standing in front of a literal army of opposition in front of us, but in life we are definitely going to face obstacles and barriers to where we need to go. And when we're faced with instructions from God, even if it seems like a daunting, scary task, do we approach it in the same way that Israel did in this moment? Remember, we've seen together Israel's gotten it wrong quite a few times, and we can identify with that. But this is one of those moments where Israel got it right. This is one of those moments where they followed the Lord the way that they should, and they approached it, what God asked them to do, with boldness, with obedience, and with commitment. So when God asks us to do something, when he instructs us to do something, to face what's ahead, are we doing so in the same way? Are we approaching it with the boldness, not of ourselves and what we can do, but of the God who has been faithful up to this point and we know will be faithful through? Will we obey him in the midst of that, even if it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us? And will we commit to doing so? You see, we've learned a lot from Israel's enemies. We've learned a lot from the pagans in the midst of our journey together in Joshua. But here, Israel actually gets it right, and we have a lot to learn from them. They followed God's instructions. They did what they were supposed to do, and we see the swift, the easy victory that takes place because of that. May we do the same today, this week, when we face these moments as well. And so we're going to zoom out for a second, but in the next section of verses 10 through 15, we see King Hazar, the head of the northern kingdoms. And again, it's just a very brief synopsis. We don't get an in-depth look, but this is the head of the northern kingdoms. They defeated the armies of the northern kingdoms, but now God wanted them to go and essentially cut the head off the snake, so to speak. Because we see in this moment that King Hazar was the one who was in charge of the very enemies that they just so swiftly defeated. And God asked them to go and to end what was going on there. And this signifies the completion of God's judgment in the midst of the Canaanite tribes. You see, chapter 11 is very important because we're going to start to see a shift in the narrative of the book of Joshua. We're only about halfway through, but there's so much more to be heard and to be understood. But this was one of the final obstacles standing in the way. They just defeated the armies, right? The hard part was done, but now it was to go and to carry out the judgment of God against the one who was in charge of it all. And God judged, Israel obeyed, and Canaan was defeated. We see almost the proverbial end of this conquest take place when that happens. And so that takes place in verses 10 through 15. And then we see, and it almost seems like the book of Joshua can end right here in chapter 11, in what we're about to read. But remember, there's 24 chapters in the book of Joshua. So there's quite a bit more that takes place. But pick up with me in verse 16 here in Joshua chapter 11. So this is now after they go, they bring God's judgment against the Canaanite tribes. And in verse 16, we start to see what God had ultimately promised. So Joshua took all of the land and all of the hill country and all the Negeb and all the land of Goshen and the lowland of Arabia and the hill country of Israel and its lowland from Mount Halak, which rises towards Seir, and Belgad, the valley of Lebanon below Mount Hermon. And he captured their kings and he struck and he put all of them to death. Joshua made war a long time with each of these kings. There was not a city that made peace with the people of Israel except the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. They took them all in battle. For it was the Lord's doing to harden their hearts so that they should come against Israel in battle in order that they should be devoted to destruction and should receive no mercy, but be destroyed just as the Lord had commanded Moses. So we see towards the end of what's taking place, the complete victory over the land and the tribes of Canaan. You see, God's judgment was accomplished through the hardened hearts of the Canaanites. And this is a point I wanted to hit because when you read it, it almost sounds like God hardened their hearts so that he could judge them. And it sounds like God might have poured out some very unfair and some very harsh judgments. But we've talked about this before, that God's judgment is never unfair. God's judgment is always warranted because God is the one who created that system. God is the one who is in control and in charge. And so when he is defeated and he has come up against him carrying out his judgment, it's not something that we can look at and say, well, is that right? Because it's God. And if he's carrying out his judgment, it's never unfair. It's never too harsh. And he dealt with their hearts the same way that he deals as all of the men's hearts. You see, it's when we hear a phrase or we read a phrase like that, like the hardening of hearts, the original language, the Hebrew that it was written in here in the Old Testament, implies that the hardening of hearts is when God allows man to be overtaken by their sinfulness. You see, when people choose again and again and again and again to give into their sinfulness, they reject God. And that's where we stand before Jesus intervenes. But we see, very similar to what happens in Romans chapter 1 and verses 24 through 28, we see God allow the people to partake in their perverse sexual sins in that particular instance, but it uses the same language, and it says that they hardened their hearts against God. Now, this wasn't God hardening their hearts so that he could deliver unfair judgment upon them, but this was them hardening their hearts against God and God judging them for that. You see, God allowed them to make a choice, and they chose sin. God allows us to make a choice, and every single time, because we are messed up, sinful, and broken people, we choose sinfulness and selfishness. We choose what we want to do, which fundamentally goes against what God wants us to do. It's a problem that we've had ever since the beginning of time, all the way back in Genesis chapter 3, when he gave Adam and Eve a choice and they chose to go against the word of God. And ever since then, we have had the same problem, the same issue. But it's not God hardening the heart so that he can pour out unfair judgment. It's God recognizing that they have turned against him, that they have hardened their hearts against him, chose sin, and because of that, they were to be judged. And it's very similar for us today under this idea of the new covenant, right? Because we have sinned and messed up and we have turned our hearts away from God. We have hardened our hearts towards God when we choose the sin in our life instead of what God wants us to do. But he loved us so much that he provided a way out of that vicious cycle of defeat through the sacrifice of Jesus. And you see here in Joshua, again, all the way back in the Old Testament, hundreds of years, generations before Jesus had even entered the scene, God had offered salvation in multiple situations through this conquest. And if we need some idea of that, God had offered salvation, forgiveness, reprieve from this idea of judgment. If you remember all the way back in chapter 2, there was a harlot pagan woman named Rahab who was a prostitute that probably more so than some of the people we've seen deserved the judgment and the punishment of God. But because she entered into, by her choice, that covenant relationship with God, she was spared and salvation was seen in that moment. Fast forward to chapter 9, we talked about a few weeks ago, the Gibeonites who were mentioned here, people that were against God. They looked and they saw who God was and what he was capable of and the judgment that was coming their way. And they said, we don't want any part of that. We want to join with him and what he's doing. And people that even in their lies and deceit to enter into that covenant relationship, entered into that covenant relationship with God where they deserved the judgment and the punishment that was to come. But because of their covenant relationship with God, they were spared. You see, salvation was offered time and time again. Rahab accepted that gift of salvation, that reprieve. The Gibeonites accepted that salvation and that reprieve. But Canaan as a whole rejected that. And once they rejected that salvation, that gift, that free gift that God gives, they hardened their hearts against him. And when they made that decision, that's what ultimately led to the judgment that we see God deliver through Joshua and Israel. And again, this points right back to us because we're in the same boat, even though we're in the New Testament era, right? We're removed from what's going on here in the Old Testament, but it's the same for us because judgment is coming. And there's one day where we are all going to have to stand before God and we are going to have to atone for everything that we have done. And the fact of the matter is there's not a person in this room that can stand before God and say, you know, I was good enough. Because God's standard is perfection. And I don't know about you, but I blew that a long time ago. God's standard is perfection. So anybody that stands before the Lord that has not been perfect throughout their entire life is deserving and worthy of the judgment that is to come, just as Canaan was deserving and worthy of the judgment that was to come against them. But salvation, forgiveness, reprieve is offered just as it was offered to Rahab, just as it was offered to the Gibeonites. It is offered to you and me through a covenant relationship with Jesus. You see, in the same way, salvation is offered to us today. And it's a gift ready for the taking. But everybody has to make that choice on their own. You see, when a gift is given, it's freely given and freely received. And those who do not receive the gift that is offered have their hearts hardened towards God. and are subject to the judgment of a holy and just God. Now that can be heavy and that can be difficult, so let's lighten the mood a little bit. This idea of receiving a gift, right? And so when a gift is presented, you have two options. You can receive it or you can reject it. I heard a story this week. I shared it with Paige earlier on. It's a fun one. So there were three sons that gathered together. They had an elderly mother that was blind. And so they got together and they said, you know, it's a special birthday. We love our mom so much. So we're going to get her the best gifts that we absolutely can. And as brothers typically do, they made it a contest to see who could get the better gift, right? I'm sure you've never experienced that with any siblings before. So the first son says, all right, guys, I got the best gift for our mother. I got her a huge house, all expenses paid. I bought it, and she's good to go. So she is set. She's got a place to live, and she is good. Good luck. Good luck topping that. I bought her a house. What you got? So the next son says, well, that's great. But I did pretty good too. You see, I bought her a Mercedes. But not only that, I bought her a driver for that Mercedes as well. And so she has her house. That's great. But I got her something as well. And the third son pipes in and he goes, oh, you guys think that you got her something good? Listen here. I got her a parrot, but not just any parrot. A parrot that can recite the entire Bible. He goes on to tell them that parrot was trained by monks in a monastery for almost a full year. However that works, a parrot being trained in the ways of the Lord is an interesting one. But the parrot was trained by monks in a monastery. He even notes that he spent almost $100,000 to make that take place. But he says she loves her Bible. And so out of all of this, she's going to enjoy my gift the most. It can recite the entire Bible to her. She can't read it, so she can hear it. So time goes on, they make their bets of who got the best gift, and finally they all receive thank you notes, well kind of, from the mother. They receive notes. So the first son received a note that said, you know, thank you for the house that you bought me, but it's too big. It's just me, I'm in one room, I live by myself, and now I have a huge house to clean. I don't think that was the gift that he was going for. So that gift, not received, right, in the way that she was thought. So the second son, the one that got the Mercedes, she said, I thank you for thinking of me, but did you forget that I don't even travel? I don't really go anywhere. So the really, really nice car that you got me just sits in the garage. I don't really do anything with it. Oh, and the driver, he's kind of rude. I don't even like him. So, again, a gift received, not in the way. Now, the third son, remember, the parrot recites the Bible, she sent him a note and said, thank you for being the only one that gave me something of use and of value, something that I enjoyed, something that I provide. That chicken was delicious. So you see, a gift given and received, though it may not have been the application that was correct, we see in those instances, those gifts were given and received. Sometimes they're not received well. A humorous take for sure, but God has given us that gift. He's extended that gift. And we can either look and say, you know, God, thanks for this whole forgiveness of sins, all that kind of stuff. But do you know what that means? Do you know that people are going to look at me and ask what I'm doing on Sunday mornings and why I'm so involved in that? It's not quite the gift I was thinking of. God, thank you for that whole idea of forgiveness of sins and all that, but that means I actually have to like go and talk to people and share about what I believe and why I believe it. That's not really for me. See, we like to pick and choose that part of that gift. But he has given us a great gift, a delicious gift, if you will, of the good news of Jesus, of the fact that we can be forgiven, that we don't have to worry about the judgment of God because the gift that we have been given is a penalty, is a payment that's already been paid by somebody who is worthy of that payment, something that we could never pay. Imagine if it came to you one day that all of your debts and everything that you owed money to had been paid off. If you went to make your next payment on whatever it is, and it said paid in full, somebody had paid it off that had the means to pay it off, how that would feel, whether it be a house note, student loans, credit card, who knows, these days, it could be anything. But imagine what it would feel like to just wake up one day to go, to be ready to make that next payment, and to realize that the debts were forgiven, that they were paid. We can imagine what that would feel like, but the fact of the matter is we have experienced that on a spiritual level, because the judgment, the wrath that God can justly and honestly give us has already been paid for. Now let's look real quick. There's in verses 21 and 22, we see almost a full circle moment here of Israel and their fight and their conquest, because there's these men, this tribe called the Ankans, that they come across. Now you might remember all the way back in the time of Moses, Numbers chapter 13 specifically, when there were spies sent into the promised land that came back. Do you remember what they said when they came back? They're giants. You should see the size of these men. They are scary. They are crazy. There is no way that we can take them on. There is no way that we can overtake them. And if you remember, their disobedience in that moment resulted in 40 years, a generation in the wilderness. And so how fitting who Israel runs into in verse 21 and 22 here, and really the ending part of their conquest of the Canaan tribes. 40 years before, Israel stood in fear of what lied ahead. And on this day, we see Israel faced with that very same tribe, that very same people, the very people that caused them to stop in their tracks 40 years ago, the very same people that, because of what they saw and the fear that they instilled in them, they didn't enter into the land of promise at that time. They had to go into the wilderness, and they see these very same people. And we see in verse 21 and 22, notice it's only two verses. They make quick work of this tribe. And it's almost ironic that the very last tribe, the very last people that they had to face in this idea of conquest of Canaan and all that took place, the very last obstacle they had to face was the first one that caused so much trouble just 40 years before. You see, in a ways only God can. Now they feel that they can face them. Now they feel that they're fully trained, that they're understanding of what's needed. Now they know that God's behind them, and they defeat them with ease. You see the full circle moment that takes place. You see, Israel allowed God to manage the battles that were before them, and when that took place, they won with ease. And when we allow God to manage the battles of our lives, we can find comfort in the fact that even when we face something that naturally makes us want to tremble in fear, if we're fighting with and for our God, we not need to be afraid. We see, and we can imagine just looking back, once this was over, I just imagine Joshua looking back and saying, because he was one of the spies that was sent out that saw these very people, and him and Caleb, who were leading the army of Israel at this time, were the two that said, well, we're fighting for God so we can do it. The other 10 said, have you seen those guys? We want no part of that. And here we are a whole generation later, almost 40 years later, and with a different mindset, with a different approach, they defeat them with ease. And then if you look in verse 23, the very last verse of the chapter, we see that it says, so Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses. And Joshua gave it to an inheritance to Israel according to their tribal allotments. And the land had rest from war. You see here in verse 23, chapter 11, we see that Israel finally does it. It's taken place. They've had to endure a lot. They've had to wander the wilderness the entire time of Moses. This has been brewing since the time of the Exodus, when Moses led them out of captivity in Egypt. This was supposed to be the next step. We're talking years and years and generations, and here they finally did it. They finally received the land of promise that was given to them. This marks a shift, as I mentioned before, in the narrative of the book of Joshua. You see, we just spent almost 6 weeks, if you can believe it or not, looking through the phases in the story about Israel's conquest to get to this point. And again, it could be really easy for the book of Joshua to just end there, right? Like they're looking and the sun's shining on all the land, and that would be a great end to a movie, right? We can just roll the credits and it would be over. But as you see, we're not done yet. But this does mark a shift in the narrative. Now it's not so much more about conquest, but as we start next week to look at the next part of Israel's time here. You see, their conquest was over, but there stood a greater invitation to continue to cooperate with God. The story didn't end here. Each tribe and each people group had the opportunity to put into practice what they had learned as a whole, full dependence on God. You see, well before they even crossed the Jordan River, well before they even entered into this land, God had already promised the victory, but he invited Israel to join in taking the inheritance that was given to them by God in the first place, the promised land. For you and for me, we're actually not in a very different spot because Jesus has already delivered the victory against sin, against the scary, daunting enemy that we stand in front of. Jesus has already delivered that victory, and we're offered to take the inheritance given to us, a better promised land, and all we have to do is to participate in that. You see, they faced a physical army, a physical threat, and they entered into their land of promise, what God had delivered to them, where things would be better and things would be the way that they should have been in the first place. And for us, we face a spiritual enemy that stands in front of us, the enemy of sin, of selfishness, of going against the word of God. But just as Joshua led the nation of Israel to a time of victory, Jesus leads us to a time of victory. And we enter into our promised land. It's not a physical promised land, but a land of promise where things are as they should have been in the very beginning, a land and a time of no sin, of no turning against God, of no death, of no pain. That's the inheritance offered to us through a relationship with Jesus. And may we continue the spread of that good news to all that we come in contact with. You see, this conquest may have ended for the nation of Israel physically, but there was still so much more to do. And so as we look at all we talked about this morning, just a couple of points for us to take away. We will face battles in life that look daunting and scary. We're going to face oppositions. We're going to face times that are difficult. But when we do, we are commanded, just as Israel was commanded, to not be afraid. And may we remember the faithfulness of God. When God asks us to do something, when he asks something of us, may we respond like Israel did in this moment that we looked at this morning, with boldness, with obedience, and with commitment to doing what God had asked us to do. And again, just like Israel, we have been given